Hello, and welcome to Season 3, Episode 3 of Our Voices, Our Community. Each week we focus on issues that are important to you and our community. We discuss an array of issues in Roanoke and New River Valley, from social to political to economics, but also arts and culture and much more. Our goal is to merge local with state and national issues that affect our lives in Southwest Virginia. On today's episode, we're going to talk about honoring or patronizing, producing change, and finding the answers. Let's get started by reintroducing ourselves. Everyone, I am Robert Jeffrey. I will be your host today. And with me, as always, Will Solari. Hey, hello, Will.
Hello.
Have Catherine Strongberg.
Hello, everybody.
And also, we always have pitch hitting for us every day, is Karen Jones. How are you?
I'm good. How are y'all?
Oh, there you go. There go y'all. Well, yes. It's interesting. We
made a return this week.
I have to be honest, folks, to the listening audience. Earlier today, we actually had earlier podcast discussion.
Pre-podcast.
We had a pre-podcast, which was very entertaining. Yeah, I wish we could take
so
it.
So entertaining. We cannot tell you
we
about
can't,
it.
We can't really.
We that, burned that, the tape.
Maybe yeah. Used too many words that could make it
yeah,
on radio.
Yeah, there was a lot of, there was some realism going on in that conversation.
a little too
but we're
going
to be real today, too. We are. We're going to be honest and real today. And the first topic, we're going to talk about honoring and patronizing. Roanoke City Council decided to postpone a sale of land for a plaza at the higher ed building to be named in honor of civil rights attorney Oliver Hill. Now, for people who don't know who Oliver Hill is, he is a civil rights attorney. He has a long history of defending cases against the school board in different areas of the state. He went to Howard Law School. Even though I'm a Hamptonian, I'll give him credit that he did go to Howard. And he was the second in his class, only the Thurgood Marshall.
Wow.
He received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And the University of Virginia honored Hill and founded the Oliver W. Hill Black Pre-Law Association. I believe he also, didn't we also name... our courthouse,
yes,
after him,
yes,
as well. So now that they're expanding the higher ed building, we're now going to have put his name again, honoring him. So, but the sale of the land has not been. City Council has not voted on this yet. They actually postponed it last week. And their lack of communication with the Gainesboro community. So they postponed it. So what are your thoughts about the fact, number one, there's another honor for Oliver Hill, and then also the fact that they've been working on this with some hesitation from the Gainesboro community and so forth, and higher ed, the people dealing with higher ed to get this going?
I mean, it does seem curious that there'd be any kind of protest to him being honored in that way, other than, again, just protocol in terms of.
I don't think it's him. I think it's the fact Gainesboro community is really a sensitive issue, especially in the African American community.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah. And I think they, seeing it, I think the expansion of the higher ed is going into the fact that, you know, the history of Gainesboro has already been taken, and now they just see it. They see it expanding more, I guess.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things that, and part of the reason for the postponement of the vote Monday, I think that was the second time it was postponed, but there had been a lack of communication with the community to begin with, and transparency. That seems to be a theme.
Oh, yeah.
In Roanoke.
Oh, yeah.
Theme lots of places, but definitely in the past few months, that just seems to be reoccurring. And I do think, though, people are beginning to address it, right? So, and I forgot her name, forgive me, the executive director or head of the higher education building, one of the reasons that she wanted to postpone this is because she wants to present plans to the community first. She and Senator Edwards had, you know, a series of town meetings after the last time this was supposed to come to a vote. So that lack of transparency and not communicating causes some of the issues. But I think the piece about naming it for Mr. Hill, which, you know, on its face, no, that's not a big deal. He was a fantastic civil rights attorney, and without him, where would we be? That type of thing. But there are also a lot of Roanokers that have made great strides, not just for the African-American community, but Southwest Virginia. But because it's in Gainesboro, it should be an African-American. And when you think about the great filmmaker Oscar Michaud was from Roanoke. So there's a lot of other people that you could think about honoring, because we do have the courthouse, which is huge. I mean, that's a really, really big deal. The marker in front of his home. So I do see where people are coming from in terms of those questions.
Right. Are we allowed to have more than one famous Black Roanoker?
Right.
That's the first question. And I think the second, and so far the answer seems to be no, which is kind of scary. I think that, I think the other part that I heard, I wasn't able to listen to a city council meeting. So I missed out on that. I was in another meeting.
Yes,
local government's been very popular lately. The other thing that I did hear from someone who was watching the Roanoke City Council meeting was that the question is, when you are trying to honor a community or to maybe even repair a community, and is this about honoring the community that was there and now is gone, or is this about repairing when the community says, when somebody says from on high, here's a plaque, and you're like, well, I didn't ask for a plaque, I asked for a repair.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is where, you know, you're coming to. You're like, okay, well, I appreciate you acknowledging that we were great. Can we talk about the part where you did harm and now we're trying to recover?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the path there? So I think that is where I really saw the, you know, at least from what I heard, where the conversation was going, like, okay, a plaque is great, but we did not ask for a plaque. There's already a lot of plaques. So do plaques, even though it's an honor, does that provide true repair? Mm-hmm. And I think that some of the people are saying that no, that comes up short. And I think that's a valid position.
You're right.
Well, and again, you know, as everybody mentioned, like, it becomes particularly complicated when you factor in Gainesboro. You know, I mean, one of my first jobs when I moved back to the city was working on a series of videos for the Harrison Museum about people who had lived through desegregation in Roanoke. And shockingly to me, and then after talking to enough people, I understood where this kind of viewpoint came from. A lot of people we talked to, a lot of the older Black community in Roanoke who lived in Gainesboro, said things were better when they were segregated. Because, and at first, again, a shocked kid who just came back from Austin, you know, mm-hmm. which despite being in Texas, seemed very progressive. I'm like, oh, everything's like this now. You know, I was taken aback a little bit by it. But when, you know, they went on to explain that, listen, we had our own police department, we had our own fire department, we had our own doctors, we had our own lawyers.
Living in the same community.
Right. And we could rely on all of them in a way that once things were desegregated, we couldn't rely on the white police department or, you know, you fill in the other service that Gainesboro had. And so you understand, I mean, that's the foundation for a lot of these decisions. So when you feel left out of those decisions, especially as most of Gainesboro was after desegregation, these things make a lot of sense where you go, hang on, great guy, but this does feel like you were saying, Catherine, this does feel like the things that are still very sore for us and that probably aren't restored even in, even probably reaching into 2020 and beyond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I know that there was opponents of the plaza were asking for the money to be spent instead of real economic investments in Gainesboro to help aid Black entrepreneurship and bring Black businesses back to the neighborhood. I think we need to really, for me, as I look at Gainesboro, because there was a lot of rich history of Gainesboro, mm-hmm. and I know that many stores and many businesses was built in that area, but they're gone. And even reshaping of Gainesboro right now,
topography.
There you go. Thank you. It's different.
Yeah.
And so, what type of businesses, I mean, what are we going to do with that type of plan?
Right, what do you envision?
What do you envision? Right. And I think that's a question, if that's going to happen, they need to have conversations about it. To me, I think we need to redirect. There's other areas in Northwest I think we need to, that are still vacant. And
waiting on the grocery store.
Waiting on grocery stores. There's other places where we can do these resources. I do see the point.
A grocery store is technically a business. I would like to bring that up.
It is. Thriving business.
Snort, sorry.
I think, you know, helping aid, bringing economic aid. To help entrepreneurship, I'm a great proponent of it. I just need to see a plan on how this is going to happen.
Well, I think this is one of the most difficult things about policies that actually work. You know, we've gotten so used to quick fixes based on politicians because it's very popular to say, oh, well, I'm going to do this tomorrow, and as soon as I'm elected, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. But really, one of the only long-term things that ever works are education, community colleges. And the reason no one ever gets real gung-ho about those things, because to see the effects of those things, it takes longer than 4 years usually. We know they work. We know they're great. It's the same way with Head Start and all those kind of things, a lot of TAPT initiatives. We know they work. They just take a long time. And so that is very hard for a lot of people, especially when they're like, well, what do we do right now? And what does this do for me right now? And lots of times it's not going to help you, especially in the immediate. But as a community and as a city and everything else, education is one of the things that has immediate, or not immediate, but has long-term and lasting effects on a community. So it's, like I said, it is a complicated
And I mean, we face some real brain drain here. I mean, I think that's true. Like, you know, you go to Howard or, you know, and somewhere
Hampton.
And I was going to come around to that.
Hampton.
And then, you know, how does Roanoke say, you know, come back here and live here and put up with some of the, you know, some of the things that maybe you wouldn't have to put up with in a DC or in a, you know, somewhere else. So
you could build a skate park.
Right. So I think that the way we have to combat the brain drain is to be actually more open to possibilities, to say like, okay, like actually this is a small community. So we can kind of like, if we so choose, we can break down barriers and make things happen and put you in charge of something or get you going on something that you could never do in DC. You could never be important enough to do in DC.
I think we need to
be thinking in that way. How do we empower the people that we have managed to lure back who have that interest and make sure that what they're doing is sustainable, right?
And along those lines, when people having that creativity, we make sure we don't stymie it.
Yeah.
We need to make sure, because we have a lot of, especially the younger generation. I can't believe I'm saying this now. I'm old.
I'm old.
But our younger generation are very creative and have a lot of great ideas. But when they start telling those ideas, I guess us old folks, I guess we always... we have to analyze everything. Slow down, and all that. And to me, you have to cultivate that.
Yeah.
You got to give them the idea, make sure they have the ability to know that they can come up with ideas and know that they have to be right the first time.
Yeah.
Right.
You're going to have failures.
Right.
You know, but again, you know, if you keep going forward, eventually you're going to have an idea at work. I think, you know, Karen and I, we have ideas every day.
I think
we're batting 0 for 100 now, but we have some ideas.
But I think this is a real thing too. And I think people assume that once something gets to any kind of official capacity, it's going to work perfectly every time. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, just like with ideas, like we have a thing called the the idea graveyard. And it's like, man, that was a really good idea. But we need to put it in the idea graveyard now so we can get to the great ideas. Right. And it's because, again, you know, the good ideas sometimes, despite best intentions and, you know, things happening in theory, don't play out the same way in real time. And then when you do get there, again, when we say, well, that didn't work, instead of going, well, now they have a better idea of what works, they go, no, next hot mm-hmm. thing, next, right. next, you know, oh, yeah, like you catchy can't and shiny an solution. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. You can't ever have a better idea. It has to be, right.
One and done.
You only get one shot, which I think is detrimental to a lot of people. So, well, we're going to follow this. I think the next vote is in January. Of mm-hmm. 2020, next year. Mm-hmm. I like to say
golly.
That. Next no! year.
In 2020.
In 2020. So that's, we're going to follow that. But I hope that, number one, I respect Oliver Hill. I'm like you, Catherine. Yeah. I think we can find another name, another African-American name in honoring what they're trying to do. Right? You know, and hopefully we can find, there's a great teachers and scholars in this area that can
all
be used.
People,
I mean, it's higher ed. I mean, so I think you want to find someone who's in that realm.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah.
So hopefully mm-hmm. we can find someone that can do that. But again, that joke, that I'm tongue tied now.
I don't know what you're trying to say.
That vote will be coming in January.
And we're not going to analyze the Freudian slip there.
No, I don't think it's a joke. I'm sorry. I apologize.
It was not a joke of a vote. It was not a vote of a joke.
No, it was not a vote of a joke. Well, let's talk about our next topic here as I'm fumbling through this podcast today. In September, students at Virginia Tech took part of the global climate strike. The strike has resulted and Virginia Tech re-examining its environmental stewardship. The Climate Action Commitment, a group of 24 faculty, students, and staff will review Tech's sustainability record. They will provide any new goals to be adopted by them, and they were from recycling rate to water usage, as greenhouse gas emissions have always emerged as a focal point. So I think right now, I think the young folks are taking over now. They're trying to make something happen here.
I would love to see it, but I have to, the cold, dark reality is that Virginia Tech literally operates a power plant, coal-fired power plant on campus. Coal-fired on campus.
Yeah.
On campus.
The good thing, though, is I would say based on the amount of money that they have the ability to fix that.
I mean, you'd think.
Well.
They say they're inventing the future. That's what I've heard my whole dang life. So.
Well, they are. But there are some, you know.
Hang on, Hokey.
Here are Christiansburg.
Right.
Look, folks, just remember, I grew up in Blacksburg. My dad worked at Virginia Tech, so... Yes.
So you're part of the problem.
When I dish... No. Well, yes, but... But when I dish out the slightly mild critique, the lukewarm critiques, let's just remember that I'm hokey and I acknowledge that.
Good.
That power plant. Power plant.
That certainly is problematic. But I think because faculty and staff and students have been working on this and kind of talking and presenting things with the administration and the Board of Supervisors. And so I think my hope is that there will be some real change, right? Not just, yeah, we might do this, or we'll add some more recycling bins, that there's some real change.
Yeah.
Because Virginia Tech has a huge impact on my entire community.
Right.
And so what happens there affects me directly.
I was in Blacksburg in the 90s mm-hmm. and I got my own personal email address like in the early 90s and I was on, what was it, BevNet? Are we flashing back?
We are
Karen
flashing
and I are
going to
have a
BevNet.
90s moment together, a 90s Montgomery County Blacksburg moment together. So, you know, I flash back to this, and I know that, like, I had this email address, and I used to, like, email my high school boyfriend at, like, 1 a.m. It was, like, the very early version of, like, whatever. I don't know. It was nothing racy. Or too terribly racy. But, like, I just... You know, we invented the future for real there. I mean, we were the mm-hmm. most wired town in America. Mm-hmm. And that, like, kind of set the standard for, like, okay, everybody's going to be on the internet. Everybody's going to have an email address. I mean, there was not much on the internet that was, like, terribly useful besides, like, a few very slowly loading websites and a lot of porn.
And Blacksburg.
Well, like, on the internet at that time.
Okay.
Right, not directly in Blacksburg.
Virtually in Blacksburg.
Virtually. The virtual village. The virtual village. The boys were very excited about the virtual village.
We're
truly inventing the future. But right now, I'm like, where is the first, like, carbon-free village? Like, where are we going to have that in America? Wow. Where is the first sustainable, truly sustainable town? Like, you have to just invest in the infrastructure. That's what Blacksburg did.
You know, I don't like to flex the okay boomer thing.
Oh, my gosh. Are you going to call me a boomer for knowing about
that? No, I'm not. But what I'm saying is that the people who are often in the power to make these decisions.
Yeah.
I worked for a nameless company once that had a 10,000 square foot roof line. And I said, you guys use a lot of electricity. You know, it would be awesome if we just covered that roof with solar cells. Here's all you need to know. It's going to cost this much. It's going to get paid back if we don't get any kind of tax credits, if we don't get anything else out of this. It's going to pay for itself in 10 years. And it's going to add 10% to the value of your building on top of the accruing, you know, whatever the inflation, everything else. Did some more math. We're going to get back $250,000 in tax credits over 5 years. It all was great. But, you know, I don't know. And it's that kind of, I'm not comfortable with change. Okay. And I think the craziest thing about that, especially in regards to climate science. Oh, and the other worst part about this is it's a great PR move. This would be a great PR move for Virginia Tech, for that company, yeah. for anyone else. Right? You can't buy that kind of advertising.
Right.
And so, despite all the things that make sense, there's people who are still hesitant about this. In the same way that there's people who still don't believe in climate change, mm-hmm. which blows my mind. Because again, a lot of these people, and I'm not trying to stereotype or characterize them, or let's just say a lot of them are pretty religious, conservative people, right? And climate change is exactly like Pascal's wager. It's the idea that, you know what, you actually benefit from believing in God, because if God doesn't exist, well, then you're fine. But if God does exist, then you're screwed, right? And so, not to weigh in on, like, the God or whatever debate, but it's the same thing with climate change. If we do all this stuff...
We're doing conversion by will.
but if we do all these things to help prevent climate change, and we were wrong about climate change, well, at least we did something good, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the air.
If we don't do anything,
yeah,
it's going to get exponentially worse.
Right, because we know by not doing anything, it's going to get worse. Right. Like, there's no reversal. And I do find it odd how Virginia Tech is at the forefront of everything, right? Like, they
operate a coal fired power plant.
Yeah.
Like, they're in engineering school, and they operate a coal fired power plant. Like, what if they took, I mean, they have that, I mean, I've contributed to the endowment at Virginia Tech. One can hardly avoid it. Like, you know, living here at some point, some sort of, you know, something request for it comes across you and you just can't say no. But what, I mean, that endowment, why is it that endowment is not just like, we're going to create a huge, amazing power plant that's going to fire our town on completely sustainable energy, and mm-hmm. you know, we're gonna create the power plant of the future that is sustainable, that is not carbon based, and you know, we're gonna create this thing, and we're gonna use our endowment funds to do it, and that's a real investment, right? Because when you invest in that kind of technology, like, can you imagine the amount of the amount of intellectual property that they would then own having done that? Yeah. I mean, it would be insane.
You also have to think about their alumni, right? Those people, think about the people who have money who went to Tech 20, 30 years ago,
They love to build things. I'm really aware of this. Building construction is very popular.
And even older than that, say 40 years ago. Hey, rich old person, we need some money because we want to do this thing. And, you know, or what is it, Board of Regents? Who's
Board of Visitors.
Think about going to them, too. A bunch of rich old people going, here's the thing we're worried about. And they're like, yeah, but we'll be dead in 10 years. So.
They're not thinking future.
Yeah.
They want something in a mind.
Can we get a bigger stadium?
Are you telling me Ray Smoot doesn't care? Because, I mean, Ray Smoot's got grandkids. I know that, okay?
But here's what's encouraging, though, I think. You have student groups like this, all right? And that's a good start. It doesn't necessarily fix or change anything. But the infrastructure... and Blacksburg as a growing and progressive city, you see that there are a lot of groups coming up right now who are doing solar power for commercial, right? And I know this again because of the failed attempt to get solar for that company I worked for, who do large scale things like this. A lot of them are tech graduates too, which helps a lot when it comes to kind of getting that nudge. And right now, they are working with people who are doing that kind of progressive views on power and climate change and stuff like that. They did a massive facility for Krillion out in Blacksburg or Christiansburg recently. Mm-hmm. So once you see the industry start turning, and there's also a bunch of manufacturing in Christiansburg that I think at some point is also going to be going green. Once the
Christiansburg,
whole...
best town in America. That's what I hear.
It is.
What's that now? What did you say?
I can attest to that.
I went to a Board of Supervisors meeting last night. I heard all about how the elementary schools are getting redone.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Well, we'll talk about that later. But I'm so excited. Sorry. I'm so excited because the primary school is still the same as it was when I went there. Oh, and so that was a long time ago. So
you're lucky.
But anyway,
you're lucky because all my schools in Montgomery County literally fell down. Okay.
Like it's about time.
So again, when industry.
Good Lord. Buildings falling down. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
We'll it's okay. When industry and all that stuff start to make that shift. When there are avenues to have private consulting, to have anything else work within that world too, I think Virginia Tech will finally probably get the message and get rid of that coal plant.
But they need to do it now and get a ton of great, awesome publicity. I mean, like, I'm sorry, you know, you can only coast on Michael Vick's fame for so long. Like, what is Virginia Tech? I mean, Virginia Tech had the most wired village in America. Yeah. They had Dolly the Sheep. I'm sorry. They need a new thing. Show me the next widget. The next widget is a power plant. Gosh darn it.
Yeah. Well, Virginia Tech, their plan is by 2025 is to use 100% renewable energy for electricity, heating, and transportation.
All right. Well, there you go. Better be a new power plant.
So they're, I didn't do something with that coal. I didn't do something with that coal. And also, University of Virginia, as well as the College of William and Mary, is announced December 2nd that they will be carbon neutral by 2030, meaning all greenhouse gas emissions produced after that will be offset through other means, such as planting trees.
That's a lot of trees to plant in the swamp.
Well, you know, and again, here's my piece of consulting advice, especially these engineering and technology schools. You know what? Don't worry about $30,000 from the person who doesn't believe in climate change. Go to the crazy people who do believe in it, like Elon Musk, and say, hey, we have a huge bus fleet. We need you, while you're making your crazy, awesome, polygon-looking truck, to figure out a way for it to make us electric commuter buses also. You can launch them here. We're going to help pay for it. We'll figure out a way, but let's do this together. And get that kind of going and off the ground.
I don't know. Elon's a little weird.
I mean, yeah, but my point is, though, it's, again, we get back
to
Pascal's...
The non-weird Elon.
Yeah, we get back to Pascal's wager, though. Is it better to get some money from a weirdo who's kind of going in the right direction? Or is it better to get a little bit of money from some old ass who doesn't believe in climate change and will only give you money if it's for, you know, more seats in the football stadium?
Yeah. Right, that you can have your name on it.
Yep.
You know.
You want the weirdo. Nice, you want the weirdo's name.
Cornerstone.
Yeah.
No.
No. Okay.
We can always look. One thing I learned at the College of William and Mary is once your name sort of falls out of favor, they just rename the building. I mean, they're not building new buildings there. They just rename them every once in a while.
Are you serious?
I am. It is. From from 1693. They're only so, it's only so big, okay?
Oh, like, that's funny.
You know, a new guy comes along and wants to give you a lot of money. You have to kind of knock somebody who's lower down the list off.
I just assumed everything William and Mary was called like Ye Old Dormitory.
Right. Or... It is. Ye Old Dormitory.
They might have
from
term limits.
Ye Old
on.
Days. But yes, there's term limits.
There's term limits on donations.
Literally. No.
Donate, you have 10 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we'll see what follows that. I do applaud the students and the faculty of Virginia Tech for re-examining their climate goals, and hopefully they'll be 100% sustainable in 2025. That's not that far from now. That's not that far.
It's really not.
It really is. It's 5 years, basically. Yeah. So we'll see.
Wow.
The future.
The future is coming, my friends. The future is coming. So we're going to take a station break, and we're going to pause and hear from our sponsor, from Richfield Living.
Experience Richfield Living. Situated on a beautiful 50-acre campus, Richfield is easily accessible to the services and attractions of the Roanoke and New River Valleys. Richfield Living is a nonprofit facility offering a continuum of award-winning care, from independent and assisted living, inpatient and outpatient rehab, to long-term and memory care. Schedule a tour today at 540-378-9772 or online at richfieldliving.com. Discover why our residents call Richfield Living home.
And we are back. Our third topic for our podcast is regarding an 18-year-old college student from Culpeper, Virginia, found dead in a jail cell from opioid toxicity compounded by asthma. The medical examiner ruled Arias Eduardo Lobo Perez's death was an accident. The official cause of death was listed from those conditions. This happened in Radford. Again, in Roanoke City, there have been other incidents of jail deaths that's been going on. And it seems like we're really not really addressing the issue about why these deaths are occurring. They're saying for this young man who was a freshman at Radford University, it was an accident. However, he was detained at 11:30, and I guess he was having breakfast. He was going to serve breakfast at 7:30. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so they offered breakfast at 7:30, and he didn't want anything. And then by the time they came back at 7:50, 7:50, he was already dead. My question, though, and the
are
thing
we
that
sure?
Kind of,
like, I don't mean to be. I mean, do we have like tape of like the 7:30 conversation?
They have the. I don't know. They have the timeline and everything. But my question is because he was arrested basically to be in the drunk tank, right? Because he went to at the New River Valley Jail facility that's in Dublin, I believe. So when you are arrested and you are already
intoxicated
or in some type of duress, you don't do anything extra. You know,
okay,
like when your friend is passed out and drunk, check on them
let
more?
Let me help you out here.
Okay.
So with the extra they normally do, mm-hmm. I will say with a lot of the Radford kids, is they bring them to New River Carillion and they let them be there. So like, and it's called, and that's fine. Like my husband accepts, you know, it's called metabolizing to freedom. Like they will watch you, they'll watch your vitals, they'll be checking on you. Like, you know, you're not going anywhere because you can barely walk. Like it's not a problem. And they, you know, if you don't seem like your vitals are stable, they have someone right there to take care of it. And I just, I don't know. I mean, they could have run a test. I mean, they do. I don't understand why this kid, I don't know why this kid passed what I consider to be go, which is go is where you go before you they determine whether or not you are healthy and stable enough to be in jail.
So you're saying the process usually is that when they find someone who's under the influence and disoriented, whatever, they arrest them, and then they'll take them to the Carilion facility?
That's what usually happens in Radford. Yeah, they take them to New River Carilion, and they say, okay, you know, like, is this person okay to come with us, or does this person stay here?
Right.
And then, like...
But they processed this young man from... They had him in the station, and then they processed him to the new... jail.
So he never went to the hospital. That's
my problem. Why didn't he see medical? Why didn't he receive medical attention? I don't understand.
Well, I think this is maybe a new question. Yeah. Well.
Oh, I have so many questions.
Yeah.
But I think this becomes a failing of our sort of modern prison, jail, whatever system, right? Robert and I were talking about this earlier. I think people, whether it's through funding or training or whatever else, expect that jail, you know, even if it's just a small intake jail in a county or a city or whatever, needs to be a catch-all, right? You go there if you have mental health issues. You go there if you have drug issues. You go there if you committed murder. You go there if you have too many tickets, right? It becomes this system by which that is too generalized take care of specific needs. And while there are protocols in place, like you were saying about...
Well, I don't know that there's a protocol. That's the thing. Well, I mean, they often do that. But the question is there a protocol? And if there isn't, why not? And why was he deemed... Like, I mean, obviously not every single person who's arrested goes to jail, goes to the hospital, get checked out before they go to jail. But like,
arrested because of intoxication.
Yes, I do believe he should have. I don't think they should have let him. I mean, especially they said that, oh, well, we could tell he was well enough that he just needed to sleep it off or something. I mean, that was my impression from the news reports.
Right.
But here's my thing. Like, you don't know. You are not a medical professional. Like, I mean, I'm sorry. You need to have somebody sign off that, like, this person's okay.
And they don't watch him. Right. Obviously, they don't watch him and monitor him based on what you're saying.
I mean...
I like that procedure when it happens to students or any adults, especially if they're under the influence or some kind of intoxication, because you don't know what's going to happen.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they can figure out what's the mix that you're under too, exactly. To some extent. Yeah. I mean, they don't necessarily know, but I mean, they do try to figure it out at the hospital. Like they can figure out some of it. And I mean, certainly if you respond to Narcan, they at least know you're under the influence of opioids. Right. So,
and then he had, what did it say? Acute asthma. Yeah. And so I think those would be things that a healthcare professional.
Well, I mean, if somebody's too intoxicated to give you a health history, you're not going to know that.
Right.
So, but you at least have, you know, you have people there who are able to, like, if you do start to, like, have problems breathing, like, they are checking on you a little bit more regularly. Like, they don't, I mean, it's not just like, oh, you know, you're in a cell. I mean, you're in a hospital. Like, you're in an emergency room. You're being, you may be even, like, hooked up to what's called a monitored bed where they're literally taking your vitals at all times. Like, that you're hooked up to something that's, like, going to alarm if something goes wonky on you.
Well, I think that does happen sometimes. But I think the problem is, you know, I think when things like this happen, people try to place a large amount of blame on one singular thing. And again, that guy's, you know, I have a ton of empathy for him because it's hard, because again, he's got an opioid problem and he's got a health condition. And while that might be the minority of people that they bring in, you know, that get arrested or whatever else for being under the influence, this is what happens when you're not prepared for those kind of things. And I think part of that, on the part of the people who are getting arrested, is this kind of view and idea of criminalization we have on people who have drug problems, right? So when you go to jail, I might have taken too many opioids, right? But I'm not going to tell them anything about opioids, because then they're going to arrest me and they're going to give me more charges, and then it's going to get worse and worse and worse for me, when really I have a problem that I need help for. And that problem, again, whether it's a rare combination or perfect storm of bad things, could cost me my life. But again, 7:30, he said, no, it's fine, whatever.
I mean, are we certain that he was alert at 7:30?
You know, the timeline, and it was actually 7:20, sorry y'all, but okay. The timeline says at 7:20, I will assume, because the state police kind of took over.
I'm making faces, which you cannot see on a podcast. Right.
I always trust the process until the process is proven to have failed. Thank you. But you know, they said they offered breakfast at 7:20, and then when they came back to a check at, you know, 7:50. So
when somebody refuses breakfast, here's my thing. I start to ask questions. What did that refusal mean? Like, if somebody wrote down in a log somewhere, refused breakfast, does that mean that he verbally said, oh, hey, no thanks, with like not slurred speech, or did he grunt? Because a grunt is not the same as, oh, no, thank you to breakfast.
And so that's
a completed sentence.
That's my question too, because they could have just walked by, do you want breakfast? And maybe he didn't say anything and they kept on going.
Yeah.
Or they left the breakfast, when they came back by, it was still there. I don't know what that means necessarily.
I would just like to know what that meant.
And so I just wonder, when you're doing that, is like you said, like, how did you do it? And then how was the response?
I mean, also, like, I will tell you another thing. In a healthcare setting, you do not offer breakfast to someone who's intoxicated unless you're certain that they're not going to aspirate it. Like, right. I mean, there's just so many layers of things here.
I think, oh my God. You know, the details, I think, of this are important, especially for someone who's trying to fix it at the same time. I feel like you have to look at the generalized nature of helping and treating people.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And again, I think if you wouldn't send the riot control police to Target if someone was shoplifting.
Right.
And the same way, we shouldn't have the same people processing and evaluating people who are, again, in there on murder, in there on drug charges, in there on not paying a jaywalking ticket.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if you had those things in place, if you had a better system for which you go, okay, this person, he's on some kind of substance, this is a problem, he goes to this place. This person is a violent offender, they go to this place. This person,
right.
You know, again, because there is a big difference in all those kind of those things. You know, someone who is premeditated a violent crime is a very different situation and needs to be treated and handled very differently than a person with a problem.
True.
Right.
And until we start differentiating those things, you're going to keep seeing stuff like this, especially with the amount of problems we have with opioids now.
It's not just the ridiculous nature of taking someone whose quote unquote crime is being intoxicated to jail. You're right. I mean, we just have to stop doing that, period, because the proper place for them, where they are truly safest and where they are often taken, is to the hospital. Mm-hmm. And the emergency department accepts these people, and it's fine. It's a major customer source.
Well, you mentioned something we were talking about earlier before the podcast. Maybe you think about, there's white collar facilities for people who committed white collar crimes and so forth. Do you think we need to find facilities, really start investing? And it's going to take money. It's going to take money, but I think it's important of saving lives. But creating facility for more for mental health and drug addiction, holding facilities, I should say.
1,000%.
Do you think that, or
I don't know. I don't know.
Do we now start saying this person goes to where the rapists and the murderers go, but this jail goes to?
But think about the way that law was handled post World War II, where the people who were police officers lived in communities that people that also were veterans, and they were all suffering from post traumatic stress, and most of them were drunks, right?
Mm-hmm.
The police would know, oh man, Craig's had too much to drink again, we're going to drive Craig home.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And there was an understanding. And I think one of the terrible things that happened in Austin was that there are drunk people there every second of every day, and they saw a way to make a lot of money off arresting people for being drunk in public, for DUIs, you name it. And what that did is it kept driving the officer's salary up. So they kept looking for more and more drunk people, and in addition to that, they started making more laws for people to stop if you were jaywalking. They could stop you and make sure you weren't drunk and whatever else. And again, it creates a system by which you're generating revenue on top of kind of doing your job. So you lose the system by which you're looking out for your community, mm-hmm. and you create a system by which you're looking out for yourself and the financial well-being of your city, county, whatever else, because of all the money that comes in mm-hmm. through that. And I think, again, that's where you look, run into those things. Well, yeah, well, you know, Officer Smith works at the jail. You know, we'll give him like a week's worth of training on intake, whatever, and, you know, good luck. Well, as where we should have a registered nurse there, as where you should have people, again, we go, oh, I would think we're pretty sure this person's on opioids. A different type of facility and a different type of method for processing this.
So, how did he even get, how did it, just somebody remind me, how did he even end up, like when we talk about where people go, right, when they're having, there's a problem, right? So like, who even, like, what was it that caused someone to call cops and not 911, we need an ambulance for someone? Like,
so good question. I don't know the circumstances of his arrest.
Was he somewhere they said he shouldn't be? Was he, like, he was just drunk in the hallway, right? Like,
I don't know.
You know, that's a good question. That's a very good question.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Was he in a dorm he wasn't supposed to be in?
No, because if he was in a dorm, the campus police would have handled that. Like,
so he was off campus.
So he had to have been off campus. And, you know, Radford doesn't have a jail, so he would have went to Dublin anyway. So yeah.
You Radford doesn't have a jail?
I don't think so.
With a college? With all those college students? I'm not saying all college students go to jail. I'm just saying, exercise
from my recollection, when people were arrested in the Radford,
you don't know anything about that. You don't know nothing about Dublin.
Like they went to Dublin. So, you know, we have a jail, you know, in Christiansburg, but, you know, from Montgomery County, but Radford doesn't have one. But I do think, and I don't want to connect this with what we were talking about earlier, like with Gainsborough, but one of the things that you said, Will, that kind of struck me was this idea, this sense of community, because when you're like in a smaller town and people know who you are, if someone picked me up and, you know, Joe, well, most of the police officers in Christiansburg, I feel like, are my friends. We all went to high school. But like, if one of them, they would be like, oh, that's Karen, blah, 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 blah. We'll just take her home.
Yeah.
At least that's what would have happened, you know, way back in the day. And so all these things that cause a loss of community, where people don't know their neighbors, don't understand what's going on, kind of the nuances with people, I think lead to some of these issues. The same way as when you're in a college community, you kind of have to deal with things a little bit differently also, because we already know that people drink and drink a lot and drink often and all of those things. So the way you handle that has to be a little bit different than you would.
In my experience, you know, growing up in Blacksburg, mm-hmm. is that the cops are incredibly tolerant of intoxication.
Very.
You know, and, you know, there's a limit to it, but there's an incredibly high tolerance in Montgomery County for mm-hmm. intoxication as long as you're not driving.
Right.
You know, there's a pretty high tolerance for it. You know, you can't be, if you're falling over. But, yeah, you know, write you a ticket, tell you to go home, that kind of thing. I do think that I'm now recalling the details. I do think this kid moved off campus. But he was back on campus he was in his old dorm, and like somehow he was like being loud and the cops got called. I think that was the circumstances of it. And I do have to say, I'm a little worried that like we're talking about a young man with at least a, you know, somewhat Hispanic mm-hmm. Surname. And so, you know, this young man, is he being, you know, was there some like kind of, you know, prejudice that contributed into this too?
And what caused it being...
Right.
Oh, yeah.
So,
back
like,
in the 50s, for sure,
why
cops weren't driving anyone but white men home.
Yeah. So who gets that kind of like, oh, yeah, here's a ticket, be on your way treatment versus like, okay, you know, you need to be taken to jail. And like the part where they skip the hospital, I mean, that just...
It's a lot of red flags.
You need to have a real set system of somebody who seems intoxicated goes to this place, because if not, we cannot be taking only the white guys to go get checked out of the hospital, and you know, the white guys who are at the football game to get checked out of the hospital, right, and leave the kids who, you know, are somewhat betwixt and between and, you know, having real issues, who are, you know, darker shades, getting hauled off to jail. That's not okay.
Absolutely.
Well, to protect and serve.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're going to follow this story. I think there's some, based on our conversation, there's a lot of unanswered questions, especially the timeline to his passing. So, I again, you know, to his family, completely sorry that this happened, and but there has to be some answers, and I know their family want those answers to that. So we'll follow that, and we'll provide updates as we move along through our podcast. So we're concluding our third episode, and so of course we always do this roundtable discussion again about what you're looking forward to, and so I always go with the ladies. And as the two ladies looking
hot
at they looking at each other. So, Karen, we're going to start with you.
So, I'm going to give a little bit of a plug to our December's publisher's note written by none other than Robert Jeffrey. And in that, he talked about this being kind of a season of giving, and, you know, we should give hope and, you know, all that wonderful stuff. And we talked about Christmas and everything last year. So, when I left you guys, well, last Thursday, we volunteered and took food for To Our House, which is the homeless shelter in that serves New River Valley. And so they stay different places throughout the time. This week, I'm looking forward to my favorite volunteer activity during the Christmas season, and that's the wrapping booth in the mall that benefits Montgomery County Emergency Program, which provides lots of services they work with To Our House, they provide rental assistance, they have a clothing bank, all of these things. And so that's my favorite volunteer activity because, one, I get to wrap gifts, which is a lot of fun, but two, I know that
gifts?
Yes, that's
I have
my
some gifts
jam.
In the car. Oh, thank you for bringing that up. Thank you, Karen.
Bring them in.
I have some gifts I need wrapping.
That is my jam.
I am terrible at wrapping gifts. I hate wrapping gifts.
Well, it's fun, but you know, people, the funnest thing about it is, well, it's probably the only time the mall in Christiansburg is busy. Yeah. But 100% of the proceeds go to McKeep. It's their largest fundraiser.
That's cool.
And so I look forward to that every year. And I encourage, if you have Christmas presents, if you need them wrapped, even if you don't need them wrapped, come by, bring a donation. I'll be there on Christmas Eve for a really long time. But yeah, so that's what I'm looking forward to.
I might come see you.
Please. Yay.
Well, I'm going to see you now.
You better have that donation ready.
Don't worry about that. I'll have it. Well, that's good, Karen. That's good. I think that's very noteworthy of doing so. I wish you success in that.
Thanks.
The gift of time.
The gift of time. There you go. Catherine, what's going on with you?
Well, I am overwhelmed, under-caffeinated, and I have got to get myself together. I'll tell you what.
it's the end of the year. I tell you, Catherine, I go through that myself.
I'm looking forward to, more than anything, just reflecting with people on the end of the year. And I was talking about this with some folks who were working on the Women's March. And we were talking about kind of asking people, like, look back on the year and leap, like leaping forward into this next year. What are kind of different emotions we were talking about and different moments. They were talking about looking back and then leaping forward. So that's going to be some upcoming Women's March questions that are going to be put out there. So I'm looking forward to hearing the answers to those questions. So and seeing what the Women's March puts together for this year. So
I like it.
Okay. Nice.
Will?
I am looking forward to not hearing about sanctuary gun cities or whatever else gun sanctuaries.
You weren't supposed to say that word
anymore. Every time I think we're done, like I thought that first thing where, you know, when someone is told they're out of order because they're shouting at city council and they're like, "You're out of order." And I'm like, okay, you know what? Like, that was a dumb exercise. You know, hopefully this is the end of it. But what, we had another round of it, what, last night?
Bring your Confederate flag to council night, apparently.
Yeah. And the irony of that is, you know, that guy, you want to be taken seriously. And you want to change people's opinions about gun owners, and not to be not to have a tyrannical government, as it were, tell you what to do. But at the same time, you're running around the city building with a giant Virginia and Confederate flag. And the irony of that is that, you know, Sic Semper Tyrannis, the Virginia state motto, you know, thus always to tyrants. But the deal is, you're carrying around a flag that stood for slavery, and that also was an enemy of the United States of America. The whole reason you say that you're there, you know, to protest your gun rights or whatever.
And, a muddled message, to be sure.
And the second I get to not hear about that anymore, that's really what I'm looking forward to.
That's gonna be a couple months in the making, I fear.
Well, I was completely appalled by the comments from the. I don't know if it was the gentleman carrying the flag.
Oh, it was. Yeah, well, it was shocker that the guy with the Confederate flag and called Joe Cava a homophobic slur.
Yeah,
that was the same guy. Are you sure?
Of course.
Yeah, I mean,
you mean the guy who wore a Confederate flag baseball cap to a official city meeting?
I mean, okay, I shouldn't, but like, I mean, to do so much discrimination just in one guy, like, I thought they would have taken turns.
Like, this is what you do, and this is what you do.
But I think it's appalling. How do you expect anyone? You're going to start calling names. And derogatory slurs like that.
Sure.
And then you want to be listened. You want people to listen to you.
Obviously,
I mean, that's
not
ridiculous.
Well, and again, it speaks extremely poorly of the people who may have been there with well-meaning intent or with just to voice their opinions or their views on something. It completely delegitimizes that entire process.
I still want to give a shout out to the one guy who came up and apologized to Karen Cobb. You are a decent man, wherever you are, whatever your name is, you were like the one decent person that first time.
Well, this is, I mean, I think this goes back to how frustrating a lot of things are, how frustrating a lot of things were in 2019. Right, it's all these people who want to be vindicated about something. They want to be angry. They want to do all these things, but then they don't actually want to do something about it. Right, like, I'm sure that a lot of those people aren't in love with our mayor right now.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Understand.
Do you say they are in love?
Aren't. To a lot of the credit, they aren't hurling racial slurs at him in public for the most part. But you know what? We had a mayor once that I found very problematic. I went to some city council meetings. I sat and I listened to what then Vice Mayor Trinkle said they were going to do about it and how that situation should be treated. And I felt like it was highly unacceptable just to be like, well, you know, he's well-meaning and, you know, we'll have an apology note or something and he'll be back to eventually when Bowers went on his thing. And I found it completely be unacceptable. I didn't get on social media and say, F you, you know, Mayor Bowers. You know, I had some pointed things to say, but they were, I like to think that they were critical, or at least required some critical thinking to get to those points. When you just get out there and you saber rattle and you scream and you're rude or whatever, these people aren't finding candidates. You know, they aren't doing something to fix the problem that they want. They expect someone to fix a problem that only they perceive. And when nothing's ever going to get done that way, and it just feeds into that same kind of negative feedback. Well, the city doesn't represent us and whatever. Okay, cool. Find a candidate that represents you. Put all this time and energy you're wasting on bringing a rebel flag to, I'm sorry, not the rebel flag, the Confederate battle flag to city council and to finding a candidate and finding someone to represent you. And if you're right, you know what? Maybe enough people will vote for that person and you can get your silly amendment into the silly thing about, you know, some non-legal binding terms that say
rights
that
they already have.
Exactly.
Yes. We will continue to uphold the Constitution in Red Oak City.
Right. And until they do that, I just don't know. I don't know. I don't know what to do with people. And I'm so glad that 2019 is over because I'm hoping that is just a symptom of 2019. All this sound and fury that signifies nothing.
Well, I hope that sound and fury does not happen in 2020. Of course,
I think it's going to be a little sound and fury in 2020.
Yeah, I think so too.
At least January 8th through March. Yeah. When does session end?
Remind me. Is there something? Is there something presidential happening in 2020?
Well, that's what I was going to bring as one of my follow ups. It's the impeachment. I believe the vote is tomorrow.
Yes.
Godspeed.
Yeah, so we know it's going to happen, but however, you know, is there already comments in the Senate? You know, you have the senator out of South Carolina. I refuse to say his name, but you know who I'm talking about, right?
Lindsey.
Yes. Yeah, well, Lindsey. He's already said he's going to make it the quickest trial. And
is that Lindsey or Mitch that says
you
that?
McConnell. No, Lindsey's no, already said he's
going to. McConnell said the Lindsey same thing. Said that. And oh, if you're on public record saying that, you need to be recused from the process then.
Yeah. Right, because you're just not doing the job that the Constitution has told you to do. The Constitution that we only sometimes want to follow. Only sometimes. Good.
Well, and that, you know, I read an interesting thing the other day about, you know, if Trump, you know, gets impeached but doesn't get removed from office. And of course, like the bullheaded idiot he is, will run in 2020. You know, they're saying he might not even attend any debates because, I mean, really, how can you have a defensible excuse for yourself when you're being held accountable publicly?
Right.
But here's the thing, well, I wouldn't expect him to because he doesn't have to. His base of supporters, along with every Republican that has been elected into office, has said your behavior is okay and we accept it.
Well, and this I've never understood this because I on one hand, sure, you want lower taxes. That's your right to like those things. Sure, you want any of the things you want. You want the trade war fixed. The trade war that you started, mm-hmm. you want that fixed magically now that you're up for impeachment. You know, there's a lot of things that I don't agree with people on, but I understand why they want them. What I do not understand is why you want them from this person.
Right.
You know, there's a ton of, I'm sure, very qualified centrist Republicans out there who could do all this without all of the damage that Donald Trump has done to our country.
I think that they gave up. I think Mittens told them that you can't win with a centrist Republican. You got to get the racist vote now.
Well, that's what some of the things I was looking forward to.
The racist vote.
I didn't want to create another podcast doing it.
Downer.
But that's what I was looking for is the vote. Also, I always take this time to reflect during the holiday season, too. I'm looking forward to that. I know as a business, as a company, we kind of slow things down as we move into the new year. I always love this time of the year because the noise is usually in the area and mm-hmm. in the community is kind of low key, and that gives me a time to take a step back and really ponder and really reflect on what 2020 is going to look like for me and our organization. So I'm really looking forward to having that time. I usually go by myself, looking at the fire. Fireplace,
deep thoughts,
a drink of something, and then
roasting chestnuts.
Yeah, exactly, roasting chestnuts, and then come back with fervor into 2020. But that's why
new
I
pace
myself. New ideas, it'll be great. So thank you guys. This has been great, a great episode. I appreciate all of you guys attending.
Thank you.
Hope to see you guys next week.
We'll be here.
Well, that sounds good. And thank you. And thank you for listening to Our Voices, Our Community, presented by Colors VA Magazine. Today's episode is sponsored by Crandall and Cott, attorney at law. You can also listen to us each Sunday at 3 p.m. on WROE 95.7 Radio Free Roanoke. If you like what you heard today, leave us a review. Also, be sure to like Our Voices, Our Community on Facebook. Thank you and have a blessed day.